Picture this, if you will. You're an OBGYN working at an outpatient clinic, and you see that a new patient's been scheduled for your next appointment. You walk into the room to see an 18-year-old female looking slightly embarrassed, who's ostensibly here to establish care. Over the course of taking the patient's history, you find out that while she has no pelvic complaints, she recently became sexually active about a month ago with her boyfriend. "That's actually the other reason I'm here," she says. "I wanted to ask about birth control. My boyfriend and I don't really like condoms, and to be honest, we just skip them half the time." You assure her that you're going to address her concerns regarding contraception, then ask if she and her partner have been tested for sexually transmitted infections, and she shakes her head no. "But won't the birth control help with that?" she asks. You consider how to educate your patient on the appropriate prevention and screening methods for sexually transmitted infections. And welcome to Audio Bricks. I'm Arjun Iyer, bringing repro topics from our bricks to your ears. After completing this section, you'll be able to 1. List the 5 most common sexually transmitted infections, or STIs, in the United States by prevalence. 2. Describe the typical appearance of STIs that present with skin lesions or discharge, and the definitive laboratory diagnosis for each. 3. Describe the recommended screening strategies for STIs in the general population. 4. Describe the use of vaccination or post-exposure prophylaxis for STI prevention. And 5. Describe the specific screening recommendations for pregnant women, adolescents, and men who have sex with men. Just so you all know, each one of the sexually transmitted infections we're about to go over could be an episode in and of itself. But because of their, shall we say, highly specific mode of transmission, the risk factors for all of them tend to be pretty similar. And from a public health perspective, this similarity allows us to discuss all of them collectively in terms of workup for individuals at risk, as well as prevention methods. Oh, and if anyone was wondering, why does Arjun keep saying STIs instead of STDs? Is this some kind of politically correct thing? Come on now, guys. It's me we're talking about. No, there's actually a pretty important reason for this change. You see, an infection is where an organism that shouldn't be there takes up residence inside your body, but a disease occurs when that organism leads to actual signs and symptoms of pathology. Nowadays, we use the term sexually transmitted infection rather than disease because a lot of the time, STIs are totally asymptomatic. And from a public health perspective, it's critically important to screen for and diagnose even asymptomatic cases to control their spread and prevent future complications. Part 1. What are the most common STIs in the United States? So here's a question for you. If you had to guess what the most common sexually transmitted infections are in order, what would you guess? Probably a lot of you just said gonorrhea or chlamydia, right? Better luck next time. In the United States, the most common STI is none other than human papillomavirus, otherwise known as HPV. And if this surprises you, it may be because the majority of the time, these patients are actually asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic. The next few are a little bit more recognizable. Second place goes to genital herpes, followed by chlamydia, then gonorrhea. And finally, the virus responsible for what is still considered to be a decades-long pandemic, HIV, or the human immunodeficiency virus. But there's a bit of a backstory to this. While there are fewer new HIV cases every year, thanks to some very smart scientists, people with HIV are actually surviving and living to old age instead of dying of AIDS. So the prevalence of HIV in the general population keeps going up, even though the incidence keeps going down. Part 2. Which STIs cause skin lesions? But hey, let's start off with some of the more clinically obvious stuff. In an ideal world, reducing the incidence of STIs would rely most heavily on prevention and screening. All too often, however, medical consideration of STIs only begins with a patient coming into my ER yelling, "There's a lump on my penis," or "vulva," or "anus." Pick your poison. So, say you take a look at the patient's penis lump, and you see 2 or 3 small papules on the glands, maybe about 3 millimeters each. They're roughly the color of his skin, but not painful. What STI do you think this represents? The answer is most likely genital warts. And I know what you're thinking. Aren't genital warts those fleshy, cauliflower-shaped lesions? Well, as it turns out, genital warts are most often just a regular old cluster of papules, though if you use a magnifying glass or a dermatoscope, they're almost always going to have at least some subtle bumpiness to them. The big confluent cauliflower-looking papules are a specific manifestation called condyloma acuminata, and both can be found either on the anal or genital regions. Genital warts are caused by two specific serotypes of HPV, specifically numbers 6 and 11. The reason this is important is because these aren't the types that cause cancer, just lumps and bumps. All right, let's try another one. What if instead of penis lumps, the patient presents with a bunch of tiny but extremely painful ulcers that look kind of like canker sores, except, you know, on your penis? What STI are we dealing with here? Most likely genital herpes. Typically herpes simplex virus 2, but given the popularity of orogenital transmission, about 15% of genital herpes is caused by HSV-1, the one commonly associated with cold sores. Now, people tend to learn about this as a primarily blistering or vesicular rash, but the blisters generally aren't present for that long before they rupture, leaving behind an extremely painful ulcer. And because the primary infection causes systemic viremia, it's not uncommon to get a flu-like illness when you first contract herpes, but less so with recurrent episodes. Finally, what if the patient only has a single large plaque about 1 centimeter across? It's ulcerated in the center like the herpes lesion, but it feels indurated, and unlike the herpetic lesions, it's got raised borders and is completely non-tender to palpation. What STI are we dealing with here? Alright, this one's pretty classic. What I'm referring to is a chancre, the first noticeable manifestation of primary syphilis, caused by the spirochete Treponema pallidum. Later on in the disease course, if the patient develops secondary or tertiary syphilis, the rash can become more widespread and take on a number of different forms, but the chancre is the primary genital lesion found with syphilis. You should also be aware of the lesion called a chancroid, which looks a lot like the chancre, but with a purulent base and with inflammation rather than induration at the border. It's caused by a bacterium called Haemophilus ducreyi, which some people remember as Haemophilus euducreyi because, oh, by the way, this lesion is very painful to the touch, unlike the chancre. All right, let's stop here to see what you remember. What are the most common STIs that cause skin lesions? There's HPV 6 and 11, which cause genital warts, HSV 2 and, less commonly, 1, which cause the ulcers and vesicles of genital herpes, and finally there's syphilis, which causes the painless chancre, and Haemophilus ducreyi, which causes the painful and inflamed chancroid. So, why is it so important to be able to recognize genital lesions? Well, as it turns out, while we do have lab tests for them, a lot of them don't come back quickly or have limited clinical utility. Genital warts due to HPV can be confirmed on biopsy, but almost nobody does that since it's pretty invasive, and lesions can usually be diagnosed by appearance alone. The diagnosis of genital herpes is done by using DNA analysis from a swab of the mucous membrane, or even better, an unroofed vesicle. The DNA is amplified to improve the sensitivity using PCR, which is not always readily available and can take a while to result. Diagnosing syphilis is probably the most cumbersome, since spirochetes are pretty difficult to culture and identify on microscopy. So, we typically use a two-stage approach. Screen for the disease with a non-treponemal test, like VDRL or RPR, and follow up the positive results with a fluorescent treponemal antibody test. Annoying, right? And since preventing spread is such an important part of managing STIs, you're not going to want to wait before encouraging patients to abstain from sexual intercourse, and in many cases, you should probably just start treating based on clinical suspicion alone. Early recognition based on the characteristic lesions is also important to prevent the complications that may arise as a result of these STIs. The HPV serotypes that cause genital warts aren't dangerous, just annoying. Genital herpes, on the other hand, can become a more systemic infection. After the primary infection, the virus generally remains dormant within the pelvic neurons. In rare cases, this can cause a peripheral neuropathy in the sacral nerves, but the serious consequence is caused by continued retrograde spread into the central nervous system, where the virus can cause a particularly aggressive form of viral meningitis and encephalitis. It's rare, like I said, but immunosuppressed patients like those with AIDS or taking immunosuppressants are at significantly higher risk. Finally, syphilis, like its spirochete cousin Lyme disease, can cause an entire spectrum of secondary and tertiary disease if it's not caught and treated early. This really deserves an entire microbiology lesson unto itself, but in brief, the disease spectrum includes diffuse skin rashes, soft tissue lesions, weakening of the vascular connective tissue leading to aortic aneurysm and dissection, and a whole spectrum of neurologic disease ranging from meningoencephalitis to progressive dementia and sensory loss. But you want to know the best part? This is all totally unnecessary, because if he catches a chancre, you can just treat it with one single shot of penicillin. So there you go. That's your incentive to stay vigilant. Now time for another knowledge check. What is the diagnostic test of choice for genital herpes? The answer is an HSV 1 and 2 PCR test of a mucosal or unroofed vesicle swab. This is also known as a nucleic acid amplification test, or NAAT. Part 3. Which STIs can cause discharge? Even more than there's a lump on my penis, urethral or vaginal discharge is probably the most common symptom that leads people to get evaluated for an STI. There's a number of different types of infections that can cause discharge, and each is associated with a slightly different type of discharge. Now, given that they not only have a characteristic appearance, but also viscosity and odor, there's really no substitute for clinical experience when it comes to identifying these. But we all gotta start somewhere, so let's start off with the buzzwords clinicians use to describe the discharge. So, let's start off simple. If a patient complains of unusual vaginal discharge and you have literally no further information, what's the most likely diagnosis? Ah, trick question. About half the time, it's not an STI at all, but rather a garden variety bacterial vaginosis, where atypical vaginal flora predominate and cause fishy-smelling vaginal discharge without evidence of inflammation. If the complaint is vaginal discharge with symptoms of inflammation, like itching, burning, and dysuria, the most likely diagnosis is Candida vulvovaginitis, or the common yeast infection. Usually this discharge is clumpy white and doesn't really have a smell to it. And, as you probably know, this isn't an STI either. Okay, Arjun, says you. Stop being cute and get to the point. What's the sexually transmitted infection that's most commonly associated with unusual vaginal discharge? The answer is trichomoniasis, caused by Trichomonas vaginalis. The discharge is typically described as thin, malodorous, and frothy. Symptoms of vulvar inflammation will also predominate, as with candidiasis, but additionally, this disease also frequently ascends and causes cervicitis, which manifests as deeper vaginal or lower abdominal pain, as well as pain or bleeding with sexual intercourse. On a speculum exam, you might even see what's described as a strawberry cervix, where the cervix is covered with tiny hemorrhagic spots. Next up, what infection would you suspect if the patient complains primarily of symptoms of cervicitis, and on exam, the discharge appears mucopurulent? Ah, now we're getting to the meat and potatoes of this topic. This presentation most characteristically describes infections with both Neisseria gonorrhoeae and Chlamydia trachomatis. And an important takeaway is that, aside from chlamydia's longer latency period, the two present in very similar ways. Both can cause urethritis, vaginitis, and cervicitis, just like trichomonas, except the discharge is typically described as mucopurulent. More importantly, both gonorrhea and chlamydia have the potential to ascend to the upper genital tract as well. In men, this means prostatitis and epididymitis, and these can become chronic and pretty difficult to treat. But the female equivalents of endometritis, salpingitis, and oophoritis, collectively referred to as pelvic inflammatory disease, are a lot worse. As you may remember, the fallopian tubes open out into the peritoneum, potentially causing peritonitis and severe sepsis. And while the majority of women with pelvic inflammatory disease, or PID, don't become severely ill, even mild PID that goes untreated can lead to chronic pelvic pain, infertility, and an increased risk of ectopic pregnancy. The gold standard diagnostic test for all three of these STIs is a PCR of a urethral, vaginal, endocervical, or anal swab, also called NAAT. You can see trichomonads or gonococci on light microscopy, but chlamydia can't be easily spotted since it's an intracellular organism. All right, pop quiz time. Which STIs can present with urethral or vaginal discharge? The answer is chlamydia, gonorrhea, and trichomonas. Nice work, gang. Now here's the bad part. Notice how I said these STIs can present with discharge? Well, when a person starts dribbling pus out of the end of their penis, they'll actually get evaluated, treated, and if they're not completely inconsiderate, abstain from sexual intercourse until the treatment is complete. But according to some studies, over half of all patients with trichomonas, gonorrhea, or chlamydia are asymptomatic at any given time point, but are still infectious, meaning they're not going to seek treatment and will probably continue to spread it around the community. So as you can see, it's not enough simply to wait around for someone to get sick. We got to get a bit more proactive with this. Part 4. How can we prevent STIs and their complications? The solution is a robust preventive approach, both primary and secondary. Primary prevention involves educating patients and the public to stop them from getting STIs in the first place. You want to make sure people know about preventing STIs by limiting the number of sexual partners and using barrier protection like condoms, as well as some of the more healthcare-specific methods like routine screening tests, vaccinations, and medications. We'll get more into those in a moment. Secondary prevention involves screening for all those asymptomatic and subclinical cases that would otherwise never get discovered until they kept getting ectopic pregnancies or start brewing a nasty lingering case of prostatitis. Now, obviously, it'd be a waste of time and resources to test every single person every year, although it probably would get rid of gonorrhea pretty quick. Fortunately, a group of public health physicians much smarter than I am have gone through the data and identified exactly which patients are at risk for which infections. And based on that data, as well as the potential consequences of an undiagnosed infection, we have a pretty good idea of which patients it makes sense to regularly test, even when asymptomatic. To start off, remind me what the most common STI is? Human papillomavirus, right. Like we mentioned, the serovars that cause warts are mostly just annoying, not painful or dangerous. But a couple of high-risk serovars are almost exclusively responsible for cervical cancer in the United States, which is why it's important to screen women. Screening is performed after age 21, traditionally using a pap smear every 3 years to assess cervical epithelial cells for dysplasia under a microscope. Even though a lot of people are sexually active well before 21, given the rate at which cervical cancer progresses, there's really no point in screening before that. At age 30, you can start substituting a PCR-based test for HPV every 5 years instead of a pap every 3 years, the reason being that a lot of younger women who are positive for the virus end up clearing the infection spontaneously through, I don't know, the miracle of youth. At age 65, screening for cervical cancer isn't recommended unless they haven't been recently tested or have other risk factors. Not because they aren't having sex anymore, which they totally are. They're just a lot more likely to die of something else long before they die of cervical cancer. Now, I have to mention this here. There is a vaccine for HPV that greatly decreases the risk of cervical cancer and genital warts, not to mention modestly decreasing the risk of anal, vulvar, and penile cancers caused by HPV. Ideally, the vaccine should be administered well before the onset of sexual activity, at age 11 or 12. But like a lot of vaccines, this has become unnecessarily controversial because parents can't handle the thought of their kids having sex. Parents, grow up. They're gonna have sex, and denial doesn't change that fact. If your patient happens to have one of those parents and never got vaccinated, once they turn 18, the ball is in their court, and patients under 21 should be offered catch-up vaccination. And while men are a lot less likely to get cancers from HPV, the benefit outweighs the negligible risk, especially when you consider the fact that preventing men from getting HPV also prevents them from giving it to women. With gonorrhea and chlamydia, women again get the short end of the stick when it comes to long-term complications, so more robust screening is recommended for women than for men. Screening is done annually if a patient has a risky sexual history, and all women under the age of 25 are considered at risk. Regarding when to start, it's controversial, but ideally when the patient becomes sexually active. But since people lie about this all the time, some have advocated for a hard start age at 15. Annual syphilis screening is also recommended for women and men with a risky sexual history, because the complications of untreated syphilis affect both populations, and because men actually make up the majority of syphilis cases. Way to go, fellas. Woo-hoo. Finally, one-time screening for HIV and hepatitis C is recommended for the general population, after age 13 for HIV and after age 18 for hepatitis C. Part 5. How do we approach STIs in special populations? So that covers screening for the general population. But certain groups either have an unusually high incidence of STIs or suffer an unusually high burden of morbidity and mortality. As we already mentioned, women below the age of 25 are by definition considered an at-risk group for gonorrhea and chlamydia and should be tested annually regardless of whether or not they have other risk factors. Men who have sex with men, or the MSM population as it's abbreviated, are at higher risk of not only gonorrhea and chlamydia, but also syphilis, and from a preventive standpoint, should be screened annually just like at-risk women, or even more frequently, depending on their sexual history. HIV and Hep C specifically run rampant among MSM and IV drug users, who can then pass the infection along by sexual transmission. Annual screening for Hep C is generally recommended for both, and is started even earlier than the general population age of 18. HIV screening is recommended annually for not just IV drug users, but also sex workers. And the MSM population, who is at the highest risk, should actually be screened every 6 or 3 months, depending on their sexual history. In addition to screening, prophylactic administration of antiretrovirals has gained traction as an evidence-based way to prevent HIV infections in the highest risk populations. It's used as regular pharmacotherapy in patients with very risky sexual histories, known as pre-exposure prophylaxis, and after high-risk exposures, as in the case of rape or needle stick, where it's known as post-exposure prophylaxis. The final special population to consider is pregnant women. As part of early prenatal screening, pregnant women should be screened for HIV and hepatitis B, both of which can be vertically transmitted to the fetus, and syphilis, which additionally causes some pretty serious birth defects. Gonorrhea and chlamydia aren't vertically transmitted, but are associated with adverse pregnancy outcomes, as well as neonatal eye and lung infections. So only pregnant women with a risky sexual history are screened. All right, let's wrap this section up with a pop quiz. Who should be screened at least annually for gonorrhea and chlamydia? So there are three key demographics here. First, women in the general population with risky sexual histories. Second, all sexually active women under the age of 25, regardless of risk factors. And third, men who have sex with men. It's also worth noting that obstetric standard of care is to screen women with risky sexual histories for gonorrhea and chlamydia at the first prenatal appointment, regardless of when the patient's last screening test was. And that's a wrap. Let's see if I've taught you guys anything about the dark side of the birds and the bees. First, can you list the 5 most common STIs in the United States in order of prevalence? In order, the 5 most common STIs are human papillomavirus, genital herpes, chlamydia, gonorrhea, and HIV. Second, can you identify 3 STIs that present primarily with genital or anal lesions? Genital herpes begins as small, fluid-filled vesicles that burst to leave behind shallow, painful ulcers. Genital warts from HPV present either as painless flesh-colored papules or as the larger cauliflower papules known as condyloma acuminata. And finally, the classic feature of primary syphilis is the single large lesion with the raised borders and an ulcerated center that is painless to the touch, known as a chancre. Third, can you identify 3 STIs that present with vaginal or urethral discharge? Chlamydia, gonorrhea, and trichomoniasis may present with vaginal or urethral discharge and symptoms of urethritis or cervicitis. And while they all have the classic appearance and smell that's in all the textbooks, in practice this is complete garbage since the physical findings overlap too much to be useful, a large proportion of the patients with these STIs are asymptomatic, and patients complaining of discharge are mostly likely to have bacterial vaginosis or candida anyway. So you need to follow this up with the appropriate testing, namely a PCR or NAAT test of a urethral, vaginal, endocervical, or anal swab, wherever the discharge or the point of sexual contact is. Next, can you list the STIs that we typically screen for in the general population? STI screening is mostly done in women, since they bear the majority of the morbidity and mortality from STIs. All females between the age of 21 and 65 should be screened for HPV or cervical dysplasia every 3 to 5 years, depending on the test used. All sexually active females under age 25 should be screened annually for gonorrhea and chlamydia, and females 25 and older should continue to be annually screened if they have a risky sexual history. All women and men with risky sexual histories should be screened for syphilis annually. And finally, all women and men should be screened at one point in their lives for both HIV and hepatitis C. Next, do you remember how screening recommendations for men who have sex with men differ from the general population? The MSM population has a particularly high prevalence of syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia, and should be screened at least annually. And while most people only need to be screened once for Hep C and HIV, The MSM population should be screened for Hep C annually and HIV every 3 to 6 months. Finally, what STIs are typically screened for in early pregnancy? The first prenatal appointment should include screening for HIV, hepatitis B, and syphilis in all women, as well as gonorrhea and chlamydia in women with risky sexual histories. Well done, gang! Now, armed with your newfound knowledge, let's revisit that patient for the beginning of the episode. An 18-year-old female presents to an OBGYN clinic to establish care and start oral contraceptives, but demonstrates some fairly common misunderstandings about STIs. What will you look for on your pelvic examination, and what screening tests are appropriate given her age and sexual history? Pause the audio if you need some time to think. An external genital examination reveals no evidence of external lesions, and an internal examination with a speculum reveals normal vaginal mucosa with normal physiologic discharge and a normal nulliparous cervix. While performing the exam, you assure her that everything looks normal, but that given her age, you need to do a couple of swabs to screen for gonorrhea, chlamydia, and syphilis. A lot of people with these infections don't have any symptoms, so we try to find them before they can cause worse problems down the line. She nods in understanding, and you send the swabs for PCR testing. You ask her if she's ever had the HPV vaccine, to which she replies, "My mom didn't really believe in that stuff." She is interested in receiving the vaccine today, however, and you administer it yourself. When you're 21, you tell her, "We should start doing a pap smear along with the other testing." When you discharge her, you inform her that while you'd be happy to prescribe oral contraceptives, they're unfortunately not going to protect her from STIs. You recommend that she and her partner keep using condoms, and while you're not sure she's completely sold on the idea, you manage to impress upon her the importance of barrier protection in preventing STIs. You decide to defer the discussion on the one-time HIV and hepatitis C screening until her next annual checkup. After today, you've given her a lot to think about already. And that's our show. Make sure to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts if you like what you heard. And remember, your feedback helps us improve. You can enjoy the full BRICS experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already. Until next time, stay healthy, and remember, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of penicillin.